from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with author and women's leadership expert Sally Helgeson, who has co-authored a new book, How Women Rise: Break the 12 Habits Holding You Back from Your Next Raise, Promotion, or Job. Sally Helgeson is an internationally acclaimed author, speaker, and leadership development consultant. Her latest book, The Female Vision, Women's Real Power at Work, explores the strategic dimension of women's leadership. Her other books include The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership, hailed as the classic work on women's leadership style, translated into 12 languages and continually in print for 20 years. And The Web of Inclusion, A New Architecture for Building Great Organizations, cited in the Wall Street Journal as one of the best books on leadership of all time. Sally delivers seminars, keynotes, and workshops for the world's leading corporations, associations, universities, and nonprofits. Here is the publisher's description of her new book. Leadership expert Sally Helgeson and best-selling leadership coach Marshall Goldsmith have trained thousands of high achievers, men and women, to reach even greater heights. Again and again, they see that women face specific and different roadblocks from men as they advance in the workplace. In fact, the very habits that helped women early in their careers can hinder them as they move up. Simply put, what got you here won't get you there, and you might not even realize your blind spots until it's too late. Are you great with details? To rise, you need to do less and delegate more. Are you a team player? To advance, you need to take credit as easily as you share it. Are you a star networker? Leaders know a network is no good unless you know how to use it. Sally and Marshall identify the 12 habits that hold women back as they seek to advance, showing them why what worked for them in the past might actually be sabotaging their future success. Building on Marshall's classic bestseller, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, their new book, How Women Rise, is essential reading for any woman who is ready to advance to the next level. When I spoke with Sally Helgeson last week, I began by asking her to talk about being a leadership expert, what this means, and how she came to do this work. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
In the 1980s, I was working in corporate communications.
Mm-hmm.
I'd previously been a journalist, and I was primarily doing speech writing. And it was the 80s, and one of the things that I noticed was what a poor job the organizations that I was working for did of understanding the talent that the women within them could bring.
Mm-hmm.
I saw great talents and potential among the women who were in the organizations, virtually none of whom were at levels where they had any kind of leadership or authority, but the organizations seem to have no idea how to work with that. In addition, I was reading a lot of books that started to be published in the 1980s for women in the workplace, and what I found is that practically everything I read, both popular and academic, emphasized how women needed to change and adapt. There was no emphasis on the kinds of skills women brought to the workplace or how those could be valuable. And I thought, you know, I want to write a book about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to profile some of America's best women leaders at that time and see how they did things. And in doing that, I became really inspired by what women leaders could contribute. And that research came together in a book called The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership, published in 1990, which I'm very proud to say was the first book to focus on what women had to contribute rather than how they needed to change and adapt. So that was pretty much the start. People started asking me to come in and speak and talk to their groups or work with groups of women internally. And I thought, boy, this is really interesting and enjoyable and very inspiring. So I kept at it. I've written 7 more books in the field,
wow,
dozens of articles, and delivered really thousands of workshops for women and women leaders all over the world, from Kuala Lumpur to Islamabad to Cairo to Tromsø in the Arctic Circle in Norway, and as well as, of course, all over the U.S.
Now,
though never, I think, in Vermont.
Not yet. Oh, okay. We have a lot of women in the workplace up here, and we have our conference centers. You have to get up here. So now, as a woman in the workplace, maybe as a young woman in the workplace before you became, you know, a leadership expert, did you make many of the mistakes that you describe in the book, or maybe we won't call them mistakes, but the 12 habits that hold women back?
Yeah, the behaviors that hold women back, I would say of the 12 that Marshall Goldsmith and I identify in How Women Rise, I would say that early in my career, I probably made 10. I probably acted on 10 of those behaviors habitually. And even, I've been at this a long time, I would say that a couple of the behaviors, such as perfectionism, sharing too much information, even though those sound opposing to one another, and a bit of reluctance to claim my own achievements, have continued to pop up, and I see them.
Yeah.
And I hear from other women, even who are remarkably accomplished. I was being interviewed by a writer from Forbes about a week ago, and we were talking and about the perfection. I believe it's habit 7 or habit 8. And she emailed me afterwards, and she said, you know, I realize I'm being so perfectionistic about this article. She said, it's really made me aware of how I still have that. So I think, you know, I'm very active and alive. I think of myself as kind of a poster child for some of these behaviors, but really I identified these behaviors by working with women in workshops all around the world. Marshall Goldsmith, my co-author, had written a wonderful book called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. Mm-hmm. And the premise of that book, the fundamental insight, which I think is brilliant, is that some of the same habits and behaviors that serve you well early in your career don't serve you as you move to a higher level.
Oh, okay.
So I was working with that in some of my workshops, especially when I was talking about being intentional about your career development. And in doing that, I realized that the behaviors in that book, some of them were gender neutral, but quite a few of them did not necessarily apply to women. For example, claiming all the credit for everything that happens.
Right.
Women don't tend to have much of a
no.
problem with that. if anything, they tend to spread credit around and are often uncomfortable accepting it themselves.
Yeah. Before we go much further, I do want to just pause on the subject of Marshall Goldsmith. I just wanted to know how it came to be that a man wanted to write How Women Rise or became involved in this project.
Exactly. Well, as I was saying, I was noticing that there were behaviors that women had that were not included in that book, and that there were other behaviors in that book that didn't necessarily apply to women. So I called Marshall and said, you know, Marshall, I've known him for 25 years. We've been colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, Marshall, I'm really finding the premise of this book to be so powerful, but it's not really working for women completely. You know, women don't have to learn to apologize, for example.
Right.
You know, women apologize for opening a door to go through it. So, you know, we don't need to worry about that. And I suggested, you know, and another colleague heard about that, and he really jumped on board. He said, boy, is that needed. So I suggested we collaborate and take that wonderful template of the idea that behaviors that got you to where you are won't necessarily help you later on in your career, but apply it and focus it really on women so that we could help women to have a greater impact in their organizations, in their communities, and the world, and have more satisfying and rewarding careers. So that's really the genesis of the book.
Okay, great. Now, the book addresses these issues about habits that women tend to have in the workplace. And in making your points, you tell the stories of a number of different women whose names have been changed in the book. I'm wondering how you found these people, and were there stories that you ended up having to cut because they wouldn't fit or they didn't work? I'm just wondering about that process.
Well, it's interesting. Here's the process. I said I do these workshops all over the world. Often the workshops will also involve panel discussions where, say, you know, it's the three women leaders at Hewlett-Packard, if I'm doing a program for Hewlett-Packard, or it's three women leaders at, you know, Fleet Financial in Boston, whatever it is, or it could be something like the Simmons Women's Leadership Conference. Uh-huh. So I do a lot of these panels, and I always insist on interviewing the panelists before and getting into real conversations with them so, you know, I know where I'm going in the panel and can make it a rich conversation. And being a journalist, I keep notes on everything, and they're, you know, really superb Jim Comey-level notes. And I file them under, you know, the event that I did. And so, and I've got a good memory. So when we were thinking about the behaviors, what would always pop up was, oh, my goodness, remember that wonderful woman on that HP panel I did who had been an engineer and had had so much difficulty bringing recognition to what she contributed? Or, oh, remember when I did that panel of five women senior law partners, and one of them was talking about, you know, how she had to really, really struggle with, you know, positioning herself as an expert
right.
on her subject matter in her firm, but not really as a rainmaker or contributor. So I would remember those stories, and I would go back and I'd read them. And so a lot of the book, I mean, some of them obviously came from Marshall's coaching as well, but a lot of the book really came from the experience I'd had doing these workshops. And
sure.
And I, you know, gave a call and talked to the women and talked to them and got more detail. And that's really how it evolved. So it was very much, afterwards I realized that, number one, the workshops I've been doing were just a fantastic laboratory for surfacing these kinds of stories that would help me understand what the behaviors were that were most likely to get into women's ways. And that, secondly, my notes were an extraordinary research resource.
Right.
So that was very satisfying, and I felt like I had the material I needed there, which is, again, you know, since I've been doing these workshops for 30 years, it's not so surprising.
Yeah. And you're not just a leadership expert for women, is that correct? You are, in your regular work, you work with men as well?
Certainly I work with men as well. And it's interesting because in the last few years, I've been working with more men. And here's the path that has taken me there. After I wrote The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership, the next book I published was called The Web of Inclusion, A New Architecture for Building Great Organizations. And it had really been inspired by The Female Advantage, because one of the women that I profiled in that book described her organization as a web of inclusion. And I thought that's a great metaphor for how organizations will have to evolve given the technology. Now, this was pre-internet, so there was no, you know, World Wide Web reference out there. It was just, it just seemed to me obvious that mm-hmm. organizations would have to become more web-like in their structure, and as they became more web-like, they would have to become more inclusive, because that's part of a web design as opposed to a hierarchy. So I wrote that book, and what's been really interesting, that book was very well received. And it's not about women's leadership. It's really five case studies of organizations that either operated as webs or had more likely divisions or units within them that operated as webs. But over the last 20 years since that, 20 plus years now, since that book was published, diversity and inclusion have become paired in people's vocabularies and in organizations. And it makes sense because what you realize is that when you have a highly diverse workforce, which people have now, the only way you can really lead it successfully is through inclusion. That if you try to lead it in a way that's very hierarchical, you're going to run into trouble with a diverse workforce. And diverse, I don't only mean diverse demographically, although I do, but I mean diverse in terms of expectations, diverse in terms of talent, diverse in terms of, you know, what people want and expect from their work. So in the last 7 or 8 years, as companies and law firms especially have, you know, developed these diversity and inclusion initiatives, I've often been brought in to work with senior executive teams on building more inclusive organizations. And what does that involve? It involves building more inclusive behaviors.
Okay.
And so I've been working with a lot of executive teams, which, you know, are usually primarily male,
right,
on what does inclusive behavior look like, and how do you not only model it yourselves, but how do you hold people in your organization accountable for it?
And that must have been really interesting in writing this book, because you've seen both sides of how people work in their jobs. I found the section on defining success a really important precursor to much of the rest of the book. This is really early in the book. You write, instead of viewing money and position as the sole or even chief markers of success, women also tend to place a high value on the quality of their lives at work and the impact of their contributions. I wonder if we can talk a little bit more about this. I thought that was interesting.
Certainly. That is something that I have noticed and really emphasized, and in the book that I did previous to this, which is called The Female Vision, Women's Real Power at Work, which looks at that, the premise of that book is that women often bring a distinctive vision based on the things they notice with them, and that that the style of women's vision and the style of women's noticing is often discounted in organizations that look at vision in a, you know, in a fairly narrow context. But without talking about vision right here, one of the things in interviewing a lot of women for that book, I interviewed quite a number of women who had left what on paper looked like fantastic jobs, well-paid, you know, high position, et cetera, really, really good jobs. And when I talked to them about why they had left those jobs, they always said the same thing. They said, I decided it just wasn't worth it. And it wasn't worth it in terms of the emotional rewards I got from it. It wasn't worth it in terms of having, of what it required of my life. It was, it was not rewarding on a day-to-day basis. It was rewarding in terms of money. It was rewarding in terms of position. But that was it. And what I concluded from the interviews I did is that it was more that women, of course, money and position are very important, and that's what this, you know, equal pay push that we're involved in right now is about. It's very important, and women are discouraged when they're underpaid, but and underengaged when they're underpaid. But great salary and great position is not enough if the quality of your life day by day is not satisfactory for many women. And what struck me in this is not necessarily what the something that organizations understand, especially in certain sectors. The idea is that if you pay someone enough money and give them a high position, they will willingly accept having a very low quality of life. No control over their time, no ability to build really satisfying relationships, mm-hmm. no ability to explore other interests. That's just not going to figure into it, and people will sort of suck it up because they're making a lot of money. But that doesn't necessarily work with women.
Right, yeah. And you say at the, I think this is toward the end, you say women are urged to go for it and aspire to leadership at the highest level. On the other hand, they're warned about the consequences of missing time with their kids. I'm not quoting you right now. That, you know, this is important. They have to think about this because it's not true that women can have it all, not easily true. And I think that kind of ties into this as well. You have to really think about what you want, figure out what success means to you and what your life will look like.
Well, we wanted to be very careful in the beginning of the book to clarify that, you know, we're talking about behaviors that get in the way of successful women, but we wanted to clarify, what does successful women mean?
Right.
When we talk about that, are we talking about CEOs? Are we talking about women in the executive suite? No, we're talking about having a successful career based on your own terms, how you define that.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? Those terms often change over life. What may be your idea, a woman's idea of a successful career when she's 30, maybe different when she's 40, and maybe different again when she's 60. We've moved out of this sort of industrial era paradigm where our ages were tied to the stages of our careers. And, you know, a lot of women especially enjoy a real burst of engagement in terms of their work after their 50s, and that's having a big impact upon our culture and our economy. Men are too. You know, we're really moving away from that ages and stages paradigm that was so dominant in the industrial era.
Okay, yeah. I want to talk specifically about a few of these 12 habits holding you back from your next raise, promotion, or job, which is the subtitle of the book. One of them that seemed quite familiar to me personally was the disease to please.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk a little bit about the disease to please?
Oh, I certainly can. It is fairly widespread.
Yeah.
When you have the disease to please, it means that you really want to be seen. It's important to you to be seen as a wonderful person by basically everyone, a nice person who meets other people's expectations. And this is one of the behaviors I think that can be particularly helpful early in your career,
right?
Because it makes you likable and people, you know, trust you.
It gets you in the door.
it gets you in the door, and it can really serve you well early in your career. But it becomes highly problematic as you move ahead, because if you really are trying to please people or wanting to be seen by everybody as a wonderful person, you're going to have trouble holding other people accountable for what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And you may end up either just ignoring if somebody isn't fulfilling on an assignment that you've given them, or you may, and this happens all the time, end up picking up the slack for them and almost sort of enabling them to not do a really terrific job. You're also going to struggle probably with saying yes too often because you're trying to please.
Yeah.
And you may have difficulty also delegating because you don't want to burden other people. So all of these things can really get in your way. We have a a wonderful example in the book, and I actually worked with this woman doing some coaching with her. She was a hospital administrator, and she'd been the head of communications for the hospital, you know, of community relations, excuse me, for the hospital. Uh-huh. And so she was very engaged with the community, and people adored this woman. And when she moved on to a higher position, the people in the community all said, oh, no, we want to work with Deborah. No, we want to work with Deborah. They did not necessarily want to work with her replacement, not because the replacement was a problem, but just because, you know, they felt comfortable with Deborah. And she ended up basically doing two jobs.
Wow.
So she wasn't doing either one that terribly well. And, of course, the woman who had taken over the job as community relations head was quite resentful of her, and she couldn't see her way through it until it was pointed out to her that, in fact, the only reason she had gotten where she was is that other people had given her development opportunities, and that she was denying that to the people around her by basically swooping in and doing all their work.
Mm-hmm.
And it really had an impact on her. And then she began to realize she was doing the same thing at home. So it's often the guilt women feel that you know, keeps them to some degree bound. And they try to fight back against that by being a wonderful person to everybody, and it doesn't, you know, they have it kind of in mind, it's an either or, either you're a wonderful person and help everybody at every opportunity, or, you know, you're sort of cold and inaccessible and rigid and power hungry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very...
It resonates with you?
Yeah, that was very interesting, that whole section.
Good.
Now, I loved the story in the chapter on minimizing. You tell the story that demonstrated how women tend to welcome people into a room, actually physically making space by making themselves smaller, whereas men in this situation, in the story that you told, did not do this. They left their arms, you know, draped over the backs of chairs. They left their belongings where they had put them. And you write, they stayed as they were, trusting the newcomers, all accomplished adults, to figure out their own seating accommodations. And I liked this on two levels. First of all, I found it, you know, true. You know, once I thought about it, I thought, yeah, that is how women would react. And also, I liked that you said why men do this. You know, they yeah. trust the newcomers as adults to figure out their... It wasn't being critical of men for not making more room. It was just like, this is how these situations differ. And I yes. thought that was great.
Thank you. You know, it's really funny. I told that story about that. It was a boardroom where I observed that happen. I told that story at a big conference I was doing at an oil company out in California.
Uh-huh.
And it was during a, you know, big sort of women's conference thing. And later there was a panel. I wasn't moderating it. A senior female executive was moderating it, of four men. And I was in the audience, you know, because I stayed there for the whole day. And all of a sudden, as I was sitting there, people kept, you know, raising their hand, looking at me and saying, Sally, 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 look up on stage. And what I realized as I looked up on stage, I started laughing so hard, is that the woman who was the moderator was sitting there with her hands in her lap and her purse under her chair and just sitting in a very self-contained way. And she had next to her a couch with four male executives, and they were so... I mean, these guys were sprawled. You would have thought it was a subway. The way they were sprawled all over it, it was amazing. So it was really an enactment of what I had been sharing before. But really, the message on that minimizing body language, and also, you know, in that chapter, we talk about minimizing ways of speaking. You know, oh, I only need a minute, or I just have one observation, that sort of thing. All those things are a way of saying, you know, I don't want to take up too much space.
I'm not important.
Yeah, and when you're feeling that, then you're not really inhabiting your space, and you can't come across with as much authority and power as you potentially have. So, it, you know, that I love that behavior, because it's something that's really easy to work on. You know, it's not that much it can be psychologically rooted, but you don't need to understand the psychology of it. You can just watch yourself or get others to watch you as well, and make sure that you show up with a bigger profile.
Yeah. Okay. All right, great. Now, I think this is related a little bit as far as the whole I'm not important thing. You have a chapter that deals with the difference between, I hope I'm remembering the wording of this correctly, the difference between building relationships and leveraging relationships.
Yes.
One chore that I find particularly onerous, and I use the word chore very mindfully, is cold calling people to ask for help, which is a little different because it's not a relationship that's established. But do you have advice or comments about this?
I do, and I think the cold calling is a great example. You are talk about somebody with this behavior. You are talking to a woman who saved her allowance all year to buy the Girl Scout cookies so I wouldn't have to go out and sell them. So I really identify with not liking cold calling. But cold calling is a really good example because I think that often women distinguish between relationships that are authentic, you know, with people they really enjoy talking to, and then relationships that have more of a transactional nature in terms of, you know, being allies, people who help you get where you want to go and where you help them get where you want to go. And what I find and have found for decades is that women are fantastic at building relationships. I mean, back in the Female Advantage, in, you know, that I was doing the research in the 80s, the biggest advantage that I saw with women was their extraordinary skill in building relationships. Mm-hmm. But as time passed, I began to think, why doesn't this relationship building skill translate more in terms of helping women achieve positions of influence? And I began to see that part of the reason was that women were often reluctant to or uncomfortable leveraging relationships, that is, using the relationships they have strategically and reciprocally.
Mm-hmm.
In order to achieve what they wanted in their career or a specific objective that they were trying to achieve on their job. If I would ask women who had really broad networks, well, are you using that? Say they were, you know, they were trying to open a new sales territory. Actually, that's a bad example because most women who would be successful in sales would be good leveragers. But, you know, they were trying to, you know, they were in a law firm and they were trying to expand their client base. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would say, you know, are you comfortable? You know these other people. Are you comfortable at enlisting their help? And often what I would hear would be, well, I don't want them to think that I'm just using them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want them to think that, you know, we're not really friends. So there was a feeling that if you brought in any kind of transactional or quid pro quo orientation into a friendship, that people would accuse you or, you know, perceive you as not really wanting to be friends with them. So it's a very either or kind of way. And what I began realizing, and I think this is so important, is that to some degree it's because when women do that, they're not really seeing themselves as a valuable resource for the other person. Because if you're really very good at leveraging relationships, you always approach, you know, can you help me on this, with the idea that then that person has the right to reciprocate and ask you to help them with something else.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see yourself as a powerful person who's going places, boy, is the person you asked a favor of lucky, because now they have you to some degree in their debt.
Right.
So I think it's not just this, you know, sort of orientation, I want so-and-so to think I'm a friend, not not, you know, that I'm not using them. But it's also a consequence of not really seeing yourself as a powerful potential resource for other people. So we have a lot of ideas in the book about, you know, how to work around that and how to get past that kind of either-or thinking. Either people are just friends or they're people that, you know, I'm using. And I social media is so interesting because, you know, it really it gives you an easy way to start leveraging relationships in order to achieve what you want.
Yeah, yeah. So here's a question that I think relates to the book as a whole. Once you recognize that you have certain habits that are holding you back, how do we change old habits? I mean, that in itself is a hard thing, even if you've recognized that they need to change.
Yeah. And if the book were just surfacing the habits, I don't think it would be landing with the impact it is.
Yeah.
What we do there is once we identify those behaviors and give examples, not just of women, not just sort of little case studies of women who enact those behaviors, but also ways in which they began to address them. But the last part of the book really focuses on a template for achieving lasting behavioral change. And the first step is always to start really small. Start with something incremental. Mm-hmm. Say you look at this. I mean, I could look at this and at the age I am now say probably 4 of these behaviors are really still an issue for me. Look at that and then think, okay, I'm going to start with one. I'm not going to be a brand new me on Monday morning. And I'm only going to start with a part of one. Say you look at one of the behaviors, which is sharing too much information, too much disclosure, too many words, not being crisp and concise in your communication, too much emphasis on words like fabulous and amazing. You know, so you're impacting your ability to sound professional. So what you want to do there, I think, is just not say, okay, I'm going to become very concise and crisp in my communication tomorrow morning, is, you know, pick a meeting where you often have to present, or a similar situation like that that's really bounded, and decide, I'm going to work in advance on making sure that what I have to say is concise. I'm going to practice the behavior of being more concise in that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to start small. And then the second thing you need to do, and I think if there's one message that permeates how women rise, this should be it. Enlist other people to help you. Don't try to do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to become more concise on your own, going in, testing it out, saying that felt better, that didn't feel better, that's good. But when you make that decision and you ask 4 or 5 people who may be going to be in that meeting, people you trust, people who you believe have your best interest at heart, would you watch me? I'm trying to become more concise. I just like any feedback you might have about whether I'm doing a good job with that or whether I'm not. And then afterwards, when they give you that feedback, don't say, oh, well, what I really meant was, no, just say thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And take it into account. Start enlisting people to help you, to give you feedback. This has so many advantages. First, you get much more information. Certain things you think that may not be working may be working, and other things that you think may be working may not be working. And when you hear it from enough people, you get a more accurate view of how you're coming across.
And that's key, isn't it? If it's multiple people, then you see a pattern.
Yeah, you see a pattern. It's,
right.
You know, it's why good coaches interview lots of people who work with the person they're coaching so they can get multiple perspectives. So it's a real, you know, coaching-rooted idea. Then you also, secondly, hold yourself accountable to some degree because now you've got somebody looking at you. So you can't, you know, just kind of go in at the last minute and say, oh, you know what, I'm not up to it today. So you're inviting someone else to help you hold yourself accountable. But thirdly, and this is so important, it makes the changes you're making visible and begins to adjust your reputation accordingly. People and organizations are really, really busy. So guess what? They're not necessarily noticing if you're changing for the better. If you've tended in the past to be somebody who's kind of all over the place in your communications, and you start getting more concise, they won't necessarily say, hey, wow, Sheila's becoming very concise in her presentations. That's not, you know, they're thinking about what they have to say.
Right.
But when you enlist other people, it's almost a form of advertising, and it begins to shift your reputation because other people are taking note. And it's really interesting. You know, Marshall did a massive study in which he found that the one factor that people who made really positive behavioral changes while being coached had in common is that they found a way to have other people in the organization hold them accountable for what they were doing. So that accountability and that ability to follow up with other people, and then how to do it. I mean, we've got a really good template, I think, for how to do that in a way that's simple and doesn't involve lots of long psychological conversations that you don't probably have time for, but that really, really works and works powerfully. So those are the first two things. And then the other is, you know, letting go of judgment. You're changing. You're not going to change all at once. You're not going to become the perfect person, even if you're a perfectionist. So you want to let go of judgment of yourself and also of others. It doesn't serve you very well. Say you invite somebody in to look at you, and they say, well, I don't know. I didn't notice you do anything differently, and they don't seem to be very responsive. Don't judge them. Just say, okay, maybe they've got something else going on. Move on. Find someone else. So all those things are important. And finally, the other thing that's really important is remember that the behaviors you're working on are also behaviors that serve you. They are rooted in strengths that you have. Women's reluctance to claim their achievements is often rooted in a real concern that others get credit. So it's rooted in generosity and rooted in modesty. And perfectionism is rooted in a commitment to excellence. And the disease to please is rooted in a desire to make other people happy. None of these are bad things. They're all good things.
Yeah.
They can just become difficult as you, they just need a different manifestation as you move to a level of authority, leadership, and influence. And so you don't want to, you want to really appreciate that these behaviors are part of what got you here, and that you're just making amendments to them to serve you better in terms of reaching your goals.
Oh, that's great. That's wonderful. Sally, I have just one last question for you.
And, okay.
I like to end by asking for advice for writers. This show is for writers as well as readers. And so I'm wondering if we can translate some of this into advice for writers, because writing has some of its own challenges as far as succeeding. And I'm just wondering if you can offer advice maybe for women who write who might benefit from knowing more about the habits that stand in our way.
Yes, well, perfectionism is going to be a big one there. And in fact, I don't think it is an accident that I've gotten 12 emails from women writers talking about how after reading the book, they realized that their perfectionism was getting in their way with what they were trying to write at that time. That,
interesting.
That Forbes columnist being one of them. And in fact, a woman who did a wonderful profile of Marshall, and I guess it was a podcast with Marshall and myself, and also an excerpt in the of the book in Strategy and Business Magazine. She was endlessly sending, like four times a day, the latest draft. You know, what do you think of these changes? What do you think of these changes? How is this? And finally, I just wrote her back and I said, Laura, are you guilty of perfectionism? You know, so I think that perfectionism, and I, you know, this is something I've struggled with. I am a person. I really am invested in the quality and clarity of my prose. I feel as a writer, you know, I have a mission as a women's leadership expert, but I have a mission as a writer, and my mission as a writer has always been the same, making complicated ideas clear. Mm-hmm. And the best compliments I've ever gotten have been from two people who came up to me and said, you know, I'm dyslexic, but I was able to read your book. So without trying to dumb down, I try to be clear. So this is a very time-intensive process, trying to be as clear as possible about complicated ideas. So I do take a lot of time to write, and I know that about myself. But I can also tell when I'm getting into something, too much perfectionism, and it usually for me manifests by the fact that I write the first paragraph, whether it's in a book or a chapter, about 30 or 40 times, mm-hmm. imagining that if I get that perfect, the rest of it will flow. So one of the things I've really learned to do is to be aware of that. And once I've given a first paragraph, three or four drafts, I just let it go and start the writing. So that's where my perfectionism, I would say, has tended to trip me up. And allied to that, I think, is ruminating, which we didn't discuss, which is one of the really important behaviors here, which is going over and over what you did, reliving your mistakes. Why was I such a jerk? You know, how could I have said that? How could I have done that? Why did I undertake this idiotic writing project? Whatever it is. It's not fruitful. We feel like it can be fruitful, that if we spend enough time regretting something, that things will change, but it's not. And so I think ruminating is a good habit to try to break if you're a writer, because you really want to think about what you're writing when you're writing. And that doesn't mean you can't be, you know, in a taxi and have a brilliant inspiration and, you know, end up going into your hotel lobby and sitting there for an hour and writing something because an idea came to you whole. But generally, I think it's a good idea to, once you're done, you're done. Right. And to clear your mind and go for a walk or call a friend or take a nap or a shower or whatever you want to do, and then let it go, let it percolate. You know, Hemingway talked about that so much. He talked about, you know, when you were finished, finish at a point. I really follow his template. Finish at a point where you know what you're going to say the next morning, so you'll have a place to start.
Yeah.
But then leave it and go do something else. Which I wouldn't recommend doing what Hemingway did, which is basically just drink. But, it is a really powerful template for being able to order a writing life. I've lived my life as a writer. I've been a full-time professional writer for 50 years. So these tricks were difficult to learn, but they're very helpful.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic advice. Thank you so much. I want to just mention again, the book is called How Women Rise, Break the 12 Habits Holding You Back from Your Next Raise, Promotion, or Job. And it's published by Hachette Books. Sally Helgeson, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This was really illuminating.
Thank you, Sheila. I've really enjoyed this.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with Sally Helgeson. We discussed her new book, How Women Rise, Break the 12 Habits Holding You Back from Your Next Raise, Promotion, or Job. It's co-authored by Marshall Goldsmith and published by Hachette Books. You can learn more about Sally's work at sallyhelgeson.com. So, this week's Write the Book prompt is a little bit different. It's not an actual writing prompt. It's to consider how any of these categories might be holding you back in your work and decide how to approach a solution for yourself. These are just a handful of the subjects covered in Sally and Marshall's book, which we discussed in our conversation. Being a pleaser, building rather than leveraging achievements, perfection, minimizing yourself or your work, and ruminating. I think that the achievements was a typo. Building rather than leveraging relationships is what that should be. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. So next up, we'll hear an interview from the archives with Diane Imrie and Richard Jarmusch. They are co-authors of the cookbook Cooking Close to Home. Diane Imrie is the University of Vermont Medical Center's Director of Nutrition Services, and Richard Jarmusch is executive chef in that organization. I spoke with them in 2009, and I began by asking them to talk about their backgrounds. I hope you enjoy our conversation. You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview from the archives with Diane Imrie and Richard Jarmusch, co-authors of the 2009 cookbook Cooking Close to Home. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.